Fight! Grawl roared. He hammered on his breastplate with his huge fist. Iron, he said. Come, Krat. Try cut Grawl's bed again. Now, Grawl, wear iron, like men wear. He began to pound on the frozen ground with his steel-shod club. Fight! He bellowed. Come, Krat, fight!
Maybe if we all go after him at once, one of us might get in a lucky thrust, Brack said, eyeing the monster speculatively.
Thy plan is flawed, my lord. We must lose several companions should we come within range of that club.
Brack looked at him in astonishment.
Prudence, Mandarallan? Prudence? From you?
It were best, I think, should I undertake this alone. My lance is the only weapon that can seek out the monster's life with any safety,
the knight stated gravely.
There is something to what he says, Hetar agreed.
Come, fight! Grawl roared again, still beating on the ground with his club.
All right, Barak agreed dubiously. We will distract him then. Come at him from two sides to get his attention. Then Mandarallan can make his charge.
What about the rock wolves? Garion asked.
Let me try something, Durnick said.
He took up a burning stick and threw it, spinning and flaring at the nervous pack surrounding the monster. The rock wolves yelped and shied quickly away from the tumbling brand.
Ah, they're afraid of the fire, all right, the smith said. I think that if we all throw at once and keep throwing, then their nerve will break and they'll all run.
They moved toward the fire.
Now! Durnick shouted sharply.
They began throwing the blazing sticks as fast as they could. The rock wolves yelped and dodged, and several of them screamed in pain as the tumbling firebrands singed them. Grawl roared in fury as the pack dodged and scurried around his feet, trying to escape the sudden deluge of fire. One of the singed beasts, maddened by pain and fright, tried to leap at him. The Aldrech jumped out of its way with astonishing agility and smashed the rock wolf to the ground with his great club.
Ugh, he's quicker than I thought, Barak said. We'll have to be careful.
They're running, Durnick shouted, throwing another fiery stick.
The pack had broken under the rain of burning brands and turned to flee, howling, back into the woods, leaving the infuriated Grawl standing alone on the riverbank, hammering at the snow-covered ground with his spiked club.
Come fight! Come fight!
He roared again and again. He advanced one huge step and smashed his club at the snow again.
We'd better do whatever we're going to do now, Silk said tensely. He's getting himself worked up. We'll have him out here on the bar with us in another minute or two.
Mandarallan nodded grimly and turned to mount his charger.
Let the rest of us distract him first, Barak said.
He drew his heavy sword.
Let's go,
he shouted, and leaped over the fire. The others followed him, spreading out in a half-circle in front of the towering Grawl. Garion reached for his sword.
Not you, Aunt Paul snapped. You stay here.
But do as I say.
One of Silk's daggers, skillfully thrown from several yards away, sank into Grawl's shoulder while the creature was advancing on Barak and Durnick. Grawl howled and turned to charge Silk and Hetar, swinging his vast club. Hetar dodged, and Silk danced back out of reach. Durnick began pelting the monster with fist-sized rocks from the riverbank. Grawl turned back, raging now, with flecks of foam dripping from his pointed tusks.
Now, Mandarallan!
Mandarallan couched his lance and spurred his warhorse. The huge armored animal leaped forward, its hooves churning gravel, jumped the fire, and bore down on the astonished Grawl. For a moment it looked as if their plan might work. The deadly steel-pointed lance was leveled at Grawl's chest, and it seemed that nothing could stop it from plunging through his huge body. But the monster's quickness again astonished them all. He leaped to one side and smashed his spiked club down on Mandarallan's lance, shattering the stout wood. The force of Mandarallan's charge, however, could not be stopped.
Horse and man crashed into the great brute with a deafening impact. Grull reeled back, dropping his club, tripping, falling with Mandorolan and his warhorse on top of him.
"Get him!"
Barak roared, and they all dashed forward to attack the fallen Grull with swords and axes. The monster, however, levered his legs under Mandorolan's thrashing horse and thrust the big animal off. A great, flailing fist caught Mandorolan in the side, throwing him for several yards. Durnik spun and dropped, felled by a glancing blow to the head, even as Barak, Hetar, and Silk swarmed over the fallen Grull.
"Father!"
Aunt Paul cried in a ringing voice. There was suddenly a new sound directly behind Geryon. First a deep, rumbling snarl, followed instantly by a hair-raising howl. Geryon turned quickly and saw the huge wolf he had seen once before in the forests of northern Arindia. The old gray wolf bounded across the fire and entered the fight, his great teeth flashing and tearing.
"Geryon, I need you!"
Aunt Paul was shaking off the panic-stricken princess and pulling her amulet out of her bodice.
"Take out your medallion, quickly!"
He did not understand, but he drew his amulet out from under his tunic. Aunt Paul reached out, took his right hand, and placed the mark on his palm against the figure of the owl on her own talisman. At the same time, she took out his medallion in her other hand.
"Focus your will," she commanded.
"On what?"
"On the amulets, quickly!"
Geryon brought his will to bear, feeling the power building in him tremendously, amplified somehow by his contact with Aunt Paul and the two amulets. Palgra closed her eyes and raised her face to the leaden sky.
"Mother!"
she cried in a voice so loud that the echo rang like a trumpet note in the narrow valley. The power surged out of Geryon in so vast a rush that he collapsed to his knees, unable to stand. Aunt Paul sank down beside him. Tenedra gasped. As Geryon weakly raised his head, he saw that there were two wolves attacking the raging Grull, the gray old wolf he knew to be his grandfather, and another, slightly smaller wolf, that seemed surrounded by a strange, flickering blue light. Grull had struggled to his feet and was laying about him with his huge fists as the men attacking him chopped futilely at his armored body. Barak was flung out of the fight and fell to his hands and knees, shaking his head groggily. Grull brushed Hetar aside, his eyes alight with a dreadful glee, as he lunged toward Barak with both huge arms raised. But the blue wolf leaped snarling at his face. Grull swung his fist and gaped with astonishment as it passed directly through the flickering body. Then he shrieked with pain and began to topple backward as Belgarath, darting in from behind to employ the wolf's ancient tactic, neatly hamstrung him with great ripping teeth. The towering Grull, howling, fell and struck the earth like some vast tree.
"Keep him down!"
Barak roared, stumbling to his feet and staggering forward. The wolves were ripping at Grull's face, and he flailed his arms, trying to beat them away. Again and again his hands passed through the body of the strange, flickering blue wolf. Mandorolan, his feet spread wide apart, holding the hilt of his broadsword with both hands, chopped steadily at the monster's body, his great blade shearing long rents in Grull's breastplate. Barak swung huge blows at Grull's head, his sword striking sparks from the rusty steel helmet. Hetar crouched at one side, eyes intent, saber ready, waiting. Grull raised his arm to ward off Barak's blows, and Hetar lunged, thrusting his saber through the exposed armpit and into the huge chest. A bloody froth spouted from Grull's mouth as the saber ripped through his lungs. He struggled to a half-sitting position. Then Silk, who had lurked just at the edge of the fight, darted in, set the point of his dagger against the back of Grull's neck, and smashed a large rock against the dagger's pommel. With a sickening crunch, the dagger drove through bone, angling up into the monster's brain. Grull shuddered convulsively, then collapsed. In the moment of silence that followed, the two wolves looked at each other across the monster's dead face. The blue wolf seemed to wink once. In a voice which Geryon could hear quite clearly, a woman's voice, she said,
"How remarkable."
With a seeming smile and one last flicker, she vanished. The old gray wolf raised his muzzle and howled, a sound of such piercing anguish and loss that Geryon's heart wrenched within him. Then the old wolf seemed to shimmer, and Belgareth knelt in his place. He rose slowly to his feet and walked back toward the fire, tears streaming openly down his grizzled cheeks. Chapter 15.
Is he going to be all right?
Barak asked anxiously, hovering over the still unconscious Durnik, as Aunt Paul examined the large purple contusion on the side of the smith's face.
It's nothing serious,
she replied in a voice seeming to droop with great weariness. Geryon sat nearby with his head in his hands. He felt as if all of the strength had been wrenched out of his body. Beyond the heaped coals of the rapidly dying bonfire, Silk and Hetar were struggling to remove Mandorallan's dented breastplate. A deep crease, running diagonally from shoulder to hip, gave mute evidence of the force of Grull's blow, and placed so much stress on the straps beneath the shoulder plates that they were almost impossible to unfasten.
I think we're going to have to cut them, Silk said.
I pray thee, Prince Keldor, avoid that if possible,
Mandorallan answered, quincing as they wrenched at the fastenings.
Those straps are crucial to the fit of the armor, and are the most difficult to replace properly. This one is coming now,
Hetar grunted, prying at a buckle with a short iron rod. The buckle released suddenly, and the taut breastplate rang like a softly struck bell.
Now I can get it,
Silk said, quickly loosening the other shoulder buckle. Mandorallan sighed with relief as they pulled off the dented breastplate. He took a deep breath and winced again.
Tinder, right here?
Silk asked, putting his fingers lightly to the right side of the knight's chest. Mandorallan grunted with pain, and his face paled visibly.
I think that you have got some cracked ribs, my splendid friend,
Silk told him.
You'd better have Palgra take a look.
In a moment,
Mandorallan said.
My horse? He will be all right,
Hetar replied.
A strained tendon in his right foreleg is all.
Mandorallan let out a sigh of relief.
I had feared for him.
I feared for us all there for a while, Silk said. Our oversized playmate there was almost more than we could handle.
It was a good fight, though, Hetar remarked.
Silk gave him a disgusted look, then glanced up at the scudding gray clouds overhead. He jumped across the glowing coals of their fire, and went over to where Belgareth sat staring in the icy river.
We are going to have to get off of this bar, Belgareth,
he urged. The weather's going bad on us again, and we will all freeze to death if we stay out here in the middle of the river tonight.
Leave me alone,
Belgareth muttered shortly, still staring at the river.
Palgra?
Silk turned to her.
Just stay away from him for a while. Go find a sheltered place for us to stay for a few days.
I'll go with you,
Barak offered, hobbling toward his horse.
You will stay here, Aunt Paul declared firmly. You creak like a wagon with a broken axle. I want to have a look at you before you get a chance to damage yourself permanently.
I know a place,
Zinedra said, rising and pulling her cloak about her shoulders. I saw it when we were coming down the river. I'll show you.
Silk looked inquiringly at Aunt Paul.
Go ahead. It's safe enough now. Nothing else would live in the same valley with an Eldrak.
Silk laughed.
Hey, I wonder why. Are you coming, princess?
The two of them mounted and rode off through the snow.
Shouldn't Durnik be coming around? Geryon asked his aunt. Let him sleep, she replied wearily. He'll have a blinding headache when he wakes up. Aunt Paul? Yes. Who was that other wolf? My mother. Poledra.
But isn't she... Yes, it was her spirit. You can do that?
Geryon was stunned by the enormity of it.
Not alone, she said. You had to help me. Is that why I feel so...
It was an effort even to talk now.
It took everything we could both raise to do it. Don't ask so many questions just now, Geryon. I am very tired, and I still have many things to do. Is Grandfather all right? He'll come around.
Mandarallan, come here.
The knight stepped over the coals at the neck of the bar and walked slowly toward her, his hand pressed lightly against his chest.
You will have to take off your shirt, she told him. And please, sit down.
About a half hour later, Silk and the princess returned.
It is a good spot, Silk reported. A thicket in a little ravine. Water, shelter, everything that we need.
Is anybody seriously hurt?
Nothing permanent.
Aunt Paul was applying a salve to Barak's hairy leg.
Do you suppose that you could hurry, Polgra?
Barak asked. It's a little chilly for standing around half-dressed.
Oh, stop being such a baby, she said heartlessly.
The ravine to which Silk and Zinedra led them was a short way back upriver. A small mountain brook trickled from its mouth, and a dense thicket of spindly pines filled it seemingly from wall to wall. They followed the brook for a few hundred yards until they came to a small clearing in the center of the thicket. The pines around the inner edge of the clearing, pressed by the limbs of the others in the thicket, leaned inward, almost touching above the center of the open area.
It is a good spot,
Hetar looked around approvingly.
How did you find it?
She did,
Silk nodded toward Zinedra.
The trees told me it was here, she said. Young pine trees babble a lot.
She looked at the clearing thoughtfully.
We will build our fire there, she decided,
pointing at a spot near the brook at the upper end of the clearing.
And set up our tents along the edge of the trees, just back from it. You will need to pile rocks around the fire and clear away all of the twigs from the ground near it. Well, these trees are very nervous about the fire. They promise to keep the wind off of us, but only if we keep our fire strictly under control. I gave them my word.
A faint smile flickered across Hetar's hawk-like face.
I'm serious,
she said, stamping her little foot.
Of course you are, Your Highness,
he replied, bowing. Because of the incapacity of the others, the work of setting up the tents and building the fire pit fell largely upon Silk and Hetar. Zinedra commanded them like a little general, snapping out her orders in a clear, firm voice. She seemed to be enjoying herself immensely. Geryon was sure that it was some trick of the fading light, but the trees almost seemed to draw back when the fire first flared up, though after a while they seemed to lean back in again to arch protectively over the little clearing. Wearily, he got to his feet and began to gather sticks and dead limbs for firewood. Bustling about the fire in a thoroughly businesslike way, Zinedra said,
Now, what would you all like for supper?
They stayed in their protected little clearing for 3 days while their battered warriors and Mandarallan's horse recuperated from the encounter with the Eldrak. The exhaustion which had fallen upon Geryon, when Aunt Paul had summoned all of his strength to help call the spirit of Poledra, was largely gone after one night's sleep, though he tired easily during the next day. He found Zinedra's officiousness in her domain near the fire almost unbearable, so he passed some time helping Durnik hammer the deep crease out of Mandorallan's breastplate. After that, he spent as much time as possible with the horses. He began teaching the little colt a few simple tricks, though he had never attempted training animals before. The colt seemed to enjoy it, although his attention wandered frequently. The incapacity of Durnik, Barak, and Mandarallan was easy to understand, but Belgareth's deep silence and seeming indifference to all around him worried Geryon. The old man appeared to be sunk in a melancholy reverie, that he could not or would not shake off.
"Aunt Paul,"
Geryon said finally on the afternoon of the third day,
"you had better do something. We'll be ready to leave soon, and Grandfather has to be able to show us the way. Right now, I don't think he even cares where he is."
Aunt Paul looked across at the old sorcerer, who sat on a rock, staring into the fire.
"Possibly you're right. Come with me."
She led the way around the fire and stopped directly in front of the old man.
"All right, Father. I think that's about enough."
"Go away, Palgra."
"No, Father. It is time for you to put it away and come back to the real world."
"That was a cruel thing to do, Paul," he said reproachfully.
"To Mother? She didn't mind."
"How do you know that? You never knew her. She died when you were born."
"And what has that got to do with it?"
She looked at him directly.
"Father," she declared pointedly, "you of all people should know that Mother was extremely strong-minded. She has always been with me. And we know each other very well."
He looked dubious.
"She has her part to play in this, just the same as the rest of us do. If you had been paying attention all of these years, you would have realized that she's never really been gone."
The old man looked around a little guiltily.
"Precisely," Aunt Paul said, with just the hint of a barb in her voice. "You really should have behaved yourself, you know. Mother's very tolerant for the most part, but there were times when she was quite vexed with you."
Belgareth coughed uncomfortably.
"Now it's time for you to pull yourself out of this and stop feeling sorry for yourself."
His eyes narrowed.
"That's not entirely fair, Palgra."
"I don't have time to be fair, Father."
"Why did you choose that particular form?"
He asked it with a hint of bitterness.
"I didn't, Father. She did. It is her natural form, after all."
"Yes, I'd almost forgotten that,"
he mused.
"She didn't."
The old man straightened and drew back his shoulders.
"Is there any food around?"
"The princess has been doing the cooking,"
Geryon warned him.
"You might want to think it over before you decide to eat anything that she's had a hand in."
The next morning, under a still threatening sky, they struck the tents, packed their gear again, and rode down along the narrow bed of the brook back into the river valley.
"Did you thank the trees, dear?" Aunt Paul asked the princess.
"Yes, Lady Palgra,"
Synedra replied.
"Just before we left."
"Oh, that's nice, then," Aunt Paul said.
The weather continued to threaten for the next 2 days, and finally the blizzard broke in full fury as they approached a strangely pyramidal peak. The sloping walls of the peak were steep, rising sharply up into the swirling snow, and they seemed to have none of the random irregularities of the surrounding mountains. Though he rejected the idea immediately, Geryon could not quite overcome the notion that the curiously angular peak had somehow been constructed, that its shape was the result of a conscious design.
"Prolgu,"
Belgareth said, pointing at the peak with one hand while he clung to his wind-whipped cloak with the other.
"How do we get up there?"
Silk asked, staring at the steep walls dimly visible in the driving snow.
"There is a road," the old man replied. "It starts over there."
He pointed to a vast pile of jumbled rock to one side of the peak.
"We had better hurry then, Belgroth. This storm isn't going to improve much."
The old man nodded and moved his horse into the lead.
"When we get up there,"
he shouted back over the sound of the shrieking wind,
"we'll find the city. It's abandoned, but you may see a few things lying about. Broken pots, a few other things. Do not touch any of them. The Ulgos have some peculiar beliefs about Prolgu. It is a very holy place to them, and everything there is supposed to stay just where it is."
"How do we get down into the caves?"
Barak asked. The Ulgos will let us in, Belgarath assured him. They already know we're here.
The road that led to the mountaintop was narrow, a ledge that inclined steeply up and around the sides of the peak. They dismounted before they started up and led their horses. The wind tugged at them as they climbed, and the driving snow, more pellets than flakes, stung their faces. It took them 2 hours to wind their way to the top, and Gary was numb with cold by the time they got there. The wind seemed to batter at him, trying to pluck him off of the ledge, and he made a special point of staying as far from the edge as he possibly could. Though the wind had been brutal on the sides of the peak, once they reached the top it howled at them with unbroken force. They passed through a broad, arched gate into the deserted city of Prolgu, with snow swirling about them and the wind shrieking insanely in their ears. There were columns lining the empty streets, tall, thick ones reaching up into the dancing snow. The buildings, all unroofed by time and the endless progression of the seasons, had a strange, alien quality about them. Accustomed to the rigid rectangularity of the structures in other cities, Geryon was unprepared for the sloped corners of Ulgo architecture. Nothing seemed exactly square. The complexity of the angles teased at his mind, suggesting a subtle sophistication that somehow just eluded him. There was a massiveness about the construction that seemed to defy time, and the weathered stones set solidly, one atop the other, precisely as they had been placed thousands of years before. Durnick seemed also to have noticed the peculiar nature of the structures, and his expression was one of disapproval. As they all moved behind a building to get out of the wind and to rest for a moment from the exertions of the climb, he ran his hand up one of the slanted corners.
"Hadn't they ever heard of a plumb line?" he muttered critically. "Where do we go to find these Ulgos?" Barak asked, pulling his bearskin cloak even tighter about him. "It's not far," Belgarath answered.
They led their horses back out into the blizzard-swept streets past the strange pyramidal buildings.
"It is an eerie place," Mandorallan said,
looking around him.
"How long has it been abandoned thus?"
"Since Torak cracked the world," Belgarath replied. "About 5,000 years.
They trudged across a broad street, through the deepening snow to a building somewhat larger than the ones about it, and passed inside through a wide doorway surmounted by a huge stone lintel. Inside, the air hung still and calm. A few flakes of snow drifted down through the silent air, sifting through the narrow opening at the top, where the roof had been, and lightly dusting the stone floor. Belgarath moved purposefully to a large black stone in the precise center of the floor. The stone was cut in such a way as to duplicate the truncated pyramid shape of the buildings in the city, angling up to a flat surface about 4 feet above the floor.
"Do not touch it," he warned them,
carefully stepping around the stone.
"Is it dangerous?"
"No. It is holy. The Ulgos don't want it profaned. They believe that Ul himself placed it here."
He studied the floor intently, scraping away the thin dusting of snow with his foot in several places.
"Let's see."
He frowned slightly. Then he uncovered a single flagstone that seemed slightly different color from those surrounding it.
"Here we are. I always have to look for it. Give me your sword, Barak."
Wordlessly, the big man drew his sword and handed it to the old sorcerer. Belgarath knelt beside the flagstone he had uncovered and rapped sharply on it 3 times with the pommel of Barak's heavy sword. The sound seemed to echo hollowly from underneath. The old man waited for a moment, then repeated his signal. Nothing happened. A third time, Belgarath hammered his 3 measured strokes on the echoing flagstone. A slow, grinding sound started in one corner of the large chamber.
"What is that?" Silk demanded nervously.
"The Ulgos," Belgarath replied,
rising to his feet and dusting off his knees.
They are opening the portal to the caves.
The grinding continued, and a line of faint light appeared suddenly about 20 feet out from the east wall of the chamber. The line became a crack, and then slowly yawned wider, as a huge stone in the floor tilted up, rising with a ponderous slowness. The light from below seemed very dim.
Belgorath,
a deep voice echoed from beneath the slowly tilting stone.
Yadho Grohaul. Yadho Grohaul, Vadmarisham,
Belgorath responded formally.
Read more, Belgorath. Marisham Ulgo,
the unseen speaker said.
What was that? Garion asked in perplexity.
He invited us into the caves, the old man said. Shall we go down now?
Chapter 16. It took all of Hetar's force of persuasion to start the horses moving down the steeply inclined passageway that led into the dimness of the caves of Ulgo. Their eyes rolled nervously as they took step after braced step down the slanting corridor, and they all flinched noticeably as the grinding stone boomed shut behind them. The colt walked so close to Garion that they frequently bumped against each other, and Garion could feel the little animals trembling with every step. At the end of the corridor, two figures stood, each with his face veiled in a kind of filmy cloth. They were short men, shorter even than Silk, but their shoulders seemed bulky beneath those dark robes. Just beyond them, an irregularly shaped chamber opened out, faintly lighted by a dim reddish glow. Belgorath moved toward the two, and they bowed respectfully to him as he approached. He spoke with them briefly, and they bowed again, pointing toward another corridor opening on the far side of the chamber. Garion nervously looked around for the source of the faint red light, but it seemed lost in the strange pointed rocks hanging from the ceiling.
We go this way,
Belgorath quietly told them, crossing the chamber toward the corridor the two veiled men had indicated to him.
Why their faces covered,
Durnick whispered.
To protect their eyes from the light when they opened the portal. But it was almost dark inside that building up there,
Durnick objected.
Not to an Ulgo, the old man replied. Don't any of them speak our language? A few, not very many. They don't have much contact with outsiders. We had better hurry. The Gorum is waiting for us.
The corridor they entered ran for a short distance and then opened abruptly into a cavern so vast that Garion could not even see the other side of it in the faint light that seemed to pervade these caves.
How extensive are these caverns, Belgorath?
Mandarallan asked, somewhat awed by the immensity of the place.
No one knows for sure. The Ulgos have been exploring the caves since they came down here, and they are still finding new ones.
The passageway they had followed from the portal chamber had emerged high up in the wall of the cavern near the vaulted roof, and a broad ledge sloped downward from the opening, running along the sheer wall. Garion glanced once over the edge. The cavern floor was lost in the gloom far below. He shuddered and stayed close to the wall after that. As they descended, they found that the huge cavern was not silent. From what seemed infinitely far away, there was the cadenced sound of chanting by a chorus of deep male voices. The words blurred and confused by the echoes reverberating from the stone walls and seemed to die off, endlessly repeating. Then, as the last echoes of the chant faded, the chorus began to sing, their song strangely disharmonic and in a mournful minor key. In a peculiar fashion, the disharmony of the first phrases, echoing back, joined the seceding phrases and merged with them, moving inexorably toward a final harmonic resolution so profound that Garion felt his entire being moved by it. The echoes merged as the chorus ended its song, and the caves of Ulgo sang on alone, repeating that final chord over
and over.
I have never heard anything like that,
Sinedra whispered softly to Aunt Paul.
Few people have,
Polgara replied,
though the sound lingers in some of these galleries for days.
What were they singing?
A hymn to Ul. It is repeated every hour, and the echoes keep it alive. These caves have been singing that same hymn for 5,000 years now.
There were other sounds as well. The scrape of metal against metal. Snatches of conversation in the guttural language of the Urugos. And an endless chipping sound, coming, it seemed, from a dozen places.
There must be a lot of them down there,
Barak observed, peering over the edge.
Not necessarily, Belgrath told him. Sound lingers in these caves. The echoes keep coming back over and over again.
Where does the light come from? Dernick asked, looking puzzled.
I don't see any torches.
The Ulgos grind two different kinds of rock to powder, Belgrath replied. When you mix them, they give off a glow.
It's pretty dim light, Dernick observed, looking down toward the floor of the cavern.
Ulgos don't need all that much light.
It took them almost half an hour to reach the cavern floor. The walls around the bottom were pierced at regular intervals with the openings of corridors and galleries radiating out into the solid rock of the mountain. As they passed, Geryon glanced down one of the galleries. It was very long and dimly lighted with openings along its walls and a few Ulgos moving from place to place far down toward the end. In the center of the cavern lay a large, silent lake, and they skirted the edge of it as Belgarath moved confidently, seeming to know precisely where he was going.
Somewhere,
from far out on the dim lake, Geryon heard a faint splash, a fish, perhaps, or the sound of a dislodged pebble from far above falling into the water. The echo of the singing they had heard when they entered the cavern still lingered, curiously loud in some places, very faint in others. Two Ulgos waited for them near the entrance to one of the galleries. They bowed and spoke briefly to Belgarath. Like the men who had met them in the portal chamber, both were short and heavy-shouldered. Their hair was very pale, and their eyes large and almost black.
"We'll leave the horses here," Belgarath said. "We have to go down the stairs. These men will care for them."
The colt, still trembling, had to be told several times to stay with his mother, but he finally seemed to understand. Then Geryon hurried to catch up to the others, who had already entered the mouth of one of the galleries. There were doors in the walls of the gallery they followed, doors opening into small cubicles, some of them obviously workshops of one kind or another, and others just as obviously arranged for domestic uses. The Ulgos inside the cubicles continued at their tasks, paying no attention to the party passing in the gallery. Some of the pale-haired people were working with metal, some with stone, a few with wood or cloth. An Ulgo woman was nursing a small baby. Behind them, in the cavern they had first entered, the sound of the chanting began again. They passed a cubicle where seven Ulgos, seated in a circle, were reciting something in unison.
They spend a great deal of time in religious observances, Belgarath remarked as they passed the cubicle. Religion is a central fact of Ulgo life.
It sounds dull, Barak grunted.
At the end of the gallery, a flight of steep, worn stairs descended sharply, and they went down, their hands on the wall, to steady themselves.
It would be easy to get turned around down here, Silk observed. I have lost track of which direction we are going.
Down, Hetar told him.
Oh, thank you, Silk replied dryly.
At the bottom of the stairs, they entered another cavern, once again high up in the wall. But this time, the cavern was spanned by a slender bridge, arching across to the other side.
We cross that, Belgarath told them,
and led them out onto the bridge that arched through the half-light to the other side. Geryon glanced down once and saw a myriad of gleaming openings dotting the cavern's wall far below. The openings did not appear to have any systematic arrangement, but rather seemed scattered randomly.
"There must be a lot of people living here,"
he said to his grandfather.
The old man nodded. "It is the home cave of one of the major Ulgo tribes."
The first disharmonic phrases of the ancient hymn to Ul drifted up to them as they neared the end of the bridge.
"I wish that they would find another tune," Barak muttered sourly. "That one is starting to get on my nerves."
"Oh, I'll mention that to the first Ulgo I meet," Silk told him lightly. "I am sure they'll only be too glad to change songs for you."
"Very funny."
"It probably has not occurred to them that their song isn't universally admired."
"Do you mind?"
"Well, they've only been singing it for 5,000 years now."
"That will do, Silk," Aunt Paul told the little man.
"Oh, anything you say, great lady," Silk answered mockingly. They entered another gallery on the far side of the cavern and followed it until it branched. Belgarath firmly led them to the left.
"Are you sure?" Silk asked. "I could be wrong, but it seems like we are going in a circle."
"We are."
"I don't suppose you'd care to explain that."
"There is a cavern we want to avoid, so we had to go around it."
"Why did we have to avoid it?"
"It is unstable. The slightest sound there might bring the roof down."
"Oh,
that's one of the dangers down here."
"You don't really need to go into the details, old friend," Silk said, looking nervously at the roof above him. The little man seemed to be talking more than usual, and Geryon's own sense of oppression at the thought of all of that rock surrounding him gave him a quick insight into Silk's mind. The sense of being closed in was unbearable to some men, and Silk, it appeared, was one of them. Geryon also glanced up and seemed to feel the weight of the mountain above pressing down firmly on him. Silk, he decided, might not be the only one disturbed by the thought of all of that dreadful mass above them. The gallery they followed opened out into a small cavern with a glass-clear lake in the center. The lake was very shallow, and it had white gravel on the bottom. An island rose from the center of the lake, and on the island stood a building constructed in the same curiously pyramidal shape as the buildings in the ruined city of Prolgu, far above them. The building was surrounded by a ring of columns, and here and there benches were carved from white stone. Glowing crystal globes were suspended on long chains from the ceiling of the cavern about 30 feet overhead, and their light, while still faint, was noticeably brighter than that in the galleries through which they had passed. A white marble causeway crossed to the island, and a very old man stood at its end, peering across the still water toward them as they entered the cavern.
"Yodho, Belgarath,"
the old man called.
"Graha'ul." "Gorim,"
Belgarath replied with a formal bow.
"Yodho, Graha'ul."
He led them across the marble causeway to the island in the center of the lake, and warmly clasped the old man's hand, speaking to him in the guttural Ulgo language. The Gorim of Ulgo appeared to be very old. He had long silvery hair and beard, and his robe was snowy white. There was a kind of saintly serenity about him that Geryon felt immediately, and the boy knew, without knowing how he knew, that he was approaching a holy man, perhaps the holiest on the earth. The Gorim extended his arms fondly to Aunt Paul, and she embraced him affectionately as they exchanged the ritual greeting.
"Yadho Graha'ul."
"Our companions don't speak your language, old friend," Belgarath said to the Gorim. "Would it offend you if we conversed in the language of the outside?"
"Not at all, Belgarath. Who tells us that it is important for men to understand one another?" Come inside, all of you. I've had food and drink prepared for you.
As the old man looked at each of them, Geryon noticed that his eyes, unlike those of the other Ulgos he had seen, were a deep, almost violet blue. Then the Gorim turned and led them along a path to the doorway of the pyramid-shaped building.
Has the child come yet?
Belgareth asked the Gorim as they passed through the massive stone doorway. The Gorim sighed.
No, Belgareth. Not yet. I am very weary. There is hope at each birth, but after a few days, the eyes of the child darken. It appears that all is not finished with me yet.
Don't give up hope, Gorim, Belgareth told his friend. The child will come in Ul's own time.
So we are told,
the Gorim sighed again.
The tribes are growing restless, though, and there is bickering, and worse, in some of the farther galleries. The zealots grow bolder in their denunciations, and strange aberrations and cults have begun to appear. Ulgo needs a new Gorim. I have outlived my time by 300 years. Ul still has work for you,
Belgareth replied. His ways are not ours, Gorim. And he sees time in a different way.
The room they entered was square, but had, nonetheless, the slightly sloping walls characteristic of Ulgo architecture. A stone table with low benches on either side sat in the center of the room, and there were a number of bowls containing fruit sitting on it. Among the bowls sat several tall flasks and round crystal cups.
I'm told that winter has already come to the mountains, the Gorim said to them. The drink should help to warm you.
It is chilly outside, Belgareth admitted.
They sat down on the benches and began to eat. The fruit was tangy and wild-tasting, and the clear liquid in the flasks was fiery and brought on an immediate warm glow that radiated out from the stomach.
Forgive us our customs, which may seem strange to you,
the Gorim said, noting that Barak and Hetar in particular approached the meal of fruit with a distinct lack of enthusiasm.
We are a people much tied to ceremony. We begin our meals with fruit and remembrance of the years that we spent wandering in search of Ul. The meat will come in due time.
Where do you obtain such food in these caves, Holy One? Silk asked politely.
Our gatherers go out of the caves at night,
the Gorim replied.
They tell us that the fruits and grains they bring back with them will grow wild in the mountains. But I suspect that they have long since taken up the cultivation of certain fertile valleys. They also maintain that the meat they carry down to us is the flesh of the wild cattle taken in the hunt. But I have my doubts about that as well.
He smiled gently.
I permit them their little deceptions.
Perhaps emboldened by the Gorim's geniality, Durnik raised a question that had obviously been bothering him since he had entered the city on the mountaintop above.
Forgive me, Your Honor,
but why do your builders make everything crooked?
What I mean is, nothing seems to be square. It all leans over.
It has to do with the weight and support, I understand,
the Gorim replied. Each wall is actually falling down. But since they are all falling against each other, none of them can move so much as a finger's width. And of course their shape reminds us of the tents that we lived in during our wanderings.
Durnik frowned thoughtfully, struggling with the alien idea.
And have you as yet recovered Aldous Orb, Belgarath?
The Gorham inquired then, his face growing serious.
Not yet, Belgarath replied. We chased Zedar as far as Nyssa, but when he crossed over into Ktar Murgos, Ktuchik was waiting. He took the orb away from him. Ktuchik has it now at Rakthol.
And Zedar?
He escaped Ktuchik's ambush and carried Torak off to Ktol Mishrak in Meloria to keep Ktuchik from raising him with the orb.
Then you will have to go to Rakthol.
Belgarath nodded, as an Ulgo serving man brought in a huge steaming roast and set it on the table, then left with a respectful bow.
Has anyone found out how Zedar was able to take the orb without being struck down?
He used a child, Aunt Paul told the Gorham. An innocent.
Ah.
The Gorham stroked his beard thoughtfully.
Does not the prophecy say, and the child shall deliver up the birthright unto the chosen one?
Yes, Belgarath replied.
Where is this child now?
So far as we know, Ktuchik has him at Rakthol.
Will you assault Rakthol, then?
I'd need an army, and it could take years to reduce that fortress. There is another way, I think. A certain passage in the Darin Codex speaks of caves under Rakthol.
I know that passage, Belgarath. It is very obscure. It could mean that, I suppose. But what if it does not?
It is confirmed by the Mrin Codex, Belgarath said a little defensively.
Ah, the Mrin Codex is even worse, old friend. It is obscure to the point of being gibberish.
I somehow have the feeling that when we look back at it, after all of this is over, we are going to find that the Mrin Codex is the most accurate version of all. I do have certain other verification, however. Back during the time when the Murgos were constructing Rakthol, a Sindarian slave escaped and made his way back to the west. He was delirious when he was found, but he kept talking of caves under the mountain before he died. Not only that, Anheg of Kharak found a copy of the Book of Torak that contains a fragment of a very old Grolim prophecy. Guard well the temple above and beneath, for Tragaska will summon foes down from the air or up from the earth to bear it away again.
And that is even more obscure, the Gorham objected.
Grolim prophecies usually are. But it is all I have got to work with. If I reject the notion of caves and a Rakthol, I'll have to lay siege to it. It would take all of the armies of the West to do that. And then, Ktuchik would summon the Angarak armies to defend the city. Everything points to some final battle. But I would prefer to pick the time and place. And the wasteland of Murgos is definitely not one of the places that I would choose.
You are leading some place with this, aren't you?
Belgarath nodded.
I need a diviner to help me find the caves beneath Rakthol, and to lead me up through them to the city.
The Gorham shook his head.
You're asking the impossible, Belgarath. The diviners are all zealots, mystics. You will never persuade one of them to leave the holy caverns here beneath the mountain. They will not leave holy Prolgo, particularly not now. All of Ulgo is waiting for the coming of the child, and every zealot is firmly convinced that he will be the one to discover the child and reveal him to the tribes. I could not even order one of them to accompany you. The diviners are regarded as holy men, and I have no authority over them.
It may not be as hard as you think, Gorim.
Belgarath pushed back his plate and reached for a cup.
The diviner I need is one named Relg.
Relg? He's the worst of the lot. He's gathered a following, and he preaches to them by the hour in some of the far galleries. He believes that he is the most important man in Ulgo just now. You will never persuade him to leave these caves.
I don't think I'll have to, Gorim. I am not the one who selected Relg. That decision was made for me long before I was born. Just send for him.
I'll send for him if you want,
the Gorim said doubtfully.
I don't think he will come, though.
He'll come,
Aunt Paul told him confidently.
He won't know why, but he will come. And he will go with us, Gorim. The same power that brought us all together will bring him as well. He does not have any more choice in the matter than we do.
Chapter 17. It all seemed so tedious. The snow and cold they had endured on the journey to Prolgu had numbed Zinedra, and the warmth here in the caverns made her drowsy. The endless, obscure talk of Belgarath and the strange, frail old Gorim seemed to pull her toward sleep. The peculiar singing began again somewhere, echoing endlessly through the caves, and that, too, lulled her to sleep. Only a lifetime of training in the involved etiquette of court behavior could keep her awake. The journey had been ghastly for Zinedra. Tolhanath was a warm city, and she was not accustomed to cold weather. It seemed that her feet would never be warm again. She had also discovered a world filled with shocks, terrors, and unpleasant surprises. At the imperial palace in Tolhanath, the enormous power of her father, the emperor, had shielded her from danger of any kind. But now she felt vulnerable. In a rare moment of absolute truth with herself, she admitted that much of her spiteful behavior toward Geryon had grown out of her dreadful new sense of insecurity. Her safe, pampered little world had been snatched away from her, and she felt exposed, unprotected, and afraid. Poor Geryon, she thought. He was such a nice boy. She felt a little ashamed that he had been the one who had to suffer from her bad temper. She promised herself that soon, very soon, she would sit down with him and explain it all. He was a sensible boy, and he would be sure to understand. That, of course, would immediately patch up the rift which had grown between them. Feeling her eyes on him, he glanced once at her, and then looked away with apparent indifference. Zinedra's eyes hardened like agates. How dared he? She made a mental note of it and added it to her list of his many imperfections. The frail-looking old Gorim had sent one of the strange, silent Ulgos to fetch the man that he and Belgarath and Lady Polgara had been discussing, and then they turned to more general topics.
Were you able to pass through the mountains unmolested?
We had a few encounters, Barak, the big red-bearded Earl of Trelheim, replied, with what seemed to Zinedra gross understatement.
But thanks to Ul, you're all safe,
the Gorim declared piously.
Which of the monsters are still abroad at this season? I have not been out of these caves in years, but as I recall, most of them seek their lairs when the snow begins.
We encountered Hrilgen, Holy One, Baron Mandarallan informed him, and some Algroths. And there was an Eldrak.
The Eldrak? It was troublesome, Silk said dryly.
Understandable. Fortunately, there aren't very many Eldrakhin. They are fearsome monsters.
Yes, we noticed that, Silk said.
Which one was it?
Groll, Belgarath replied. He and I had met before, and he seemed to hold a grudge. I am sorry, Gurim, but we had to kill him. There was not any other way.
Ah, the Gorum said with a slight note of pain in his voice. Poor Groll.
I personally don't miss him very much. I'm not trying to be forward, Holy One, Barak said. But don't you think it might be a good idea to exterminate some of the more troublesome beasts in these mountains?
They are the children of Ul, even as we, the Gorum explained.
But if they were not out there, you could return to the world above, Barak pointed out.
The Gorum smiled.
No, he said gently. Ulko will never leave the caves now. We have dwelt here for 5 millennia, and over the years we have changed. Our eyes could not bear the sunlight now. The monsters above cannot reach us here, and their presence in these mountains keeps strangers out of Ulgo. We're not at ease with strangers, really. So it is probably for the best.
The Gorum was sitting directly across the narrow stone table from Zenedra. The subject of the monsters obviously pained him, and he looked at her for a moment, then gently reached out his frail old hand and cupped her little chin in it, lifting her face to the dim light of the hanging globe suspended above the table.
All of the alien creatures are not monsters, he said, his large violet eyes calm and very wise. Consider the beauty of the dryad.
Zenedra was a little startled, not by his touch, certainly, for older people had responded to her flower-like face with that same gesture for as long as she could remember, but rather by the ancient man's immediate recognition of the fact that she was not entirely human.
"Tell me, child," the Gorum asked, "do the dryads still honor Ul?"
She was completely unprepared for the question.
I am sorry, Holy One, she floundered. Until quite recently, I had not even heard of the god Ul. For some reason, my tutors have very little information about your people or your god.
The princess was raised as a Tolnedrin, Lady Palgra explained. She is a Borun. I am sure you've heard of the link between that house and the dryads. As a Tolnedrin, her religious affiliation is to Nedra.
A serviceable god, the Gorum said. Perhaps a bit stuffy for my taste, but certainly adequate. The dryads themselves, though, do they still know their god?
Belgareth coughed a bit apologetically.
I'm afraid not, Gorim. They have drifted away, and the aeons have erased what they knew of Ul. They are flighty creatures, anyway, not much given to religious observances.
The Gorim's face was sad.
What god do they honor now?
None, actually, Belgareth admitted. They have a few sacred groves, a rough idol or two, fashioned from the root of a particularly venerated tree. That's about it. They don't really have any clearly formulated theology.
Zenedra found the whole discussion a trifle offensive. Rising to the occasion, she drew herself up slightly and smiled winsomely at the old Gorim. She knew exactly how to charm an elderly man. She had practiced for years on her father, the Emperor.
I feel the shortcomings of my education most keenly, Holy One,
she lied.
Since mysterious Ul is the hereditary god of the Dryads, I should know him.
I hope that someday soon I may receive instruction concerning him. It may be that I, unworthy though I am, can be the instrument of renewing the allegiance of my sisters to their rightful God.
It was an artful little speech, and on the whole, Tenedra was rather proud of it. To her surprise, however, the Gorum was not satisfied to accept a vague expression of interest and let it go at that.
Tell your sisters that the core of our faith is to be found in the Book of Ulgo,
he told her seriously.
The Book of Ulgo?
She repeated.
I must remember that. As soon as I return to Tolhanath, I will obtain a copy and deliver it to the Wood of the Dryads personally.
That, she thought, should satisfy him.
I'm afraid that such copies as you would find in Tolhanath would be much corrupted,
the Gorum told her.
The tongue of my people is not easily understood by strangers, and translations are difficult.
Tenedra definitely felt that the dear old man was becoming just a bit tiresome about this whole thing.
As is so often the case with the scriptures, our holy book is bound up in our history. The wisdom of the gods is such that their instruction is concealed within stories. Our minds delight in the stories, and the messages of the gods are implanted thus. All unaware, we are instructed even as we are entertained.
Tenedra was familiar with the theory. Master Jeebers, her tutor, had lectured her tediously concerning it. She cast about rather desperately, trying to find some graceful way to change the subject.
Our story is very old,
the Gorum continued inexorably.
Would you like to hear it?
Caught by her own cleverness, Tenedra could only nod helplessly. And so the Gorum began.
At the beginning of days, when the world was spun out of darkness by the wavered gods, there dwelt in the silences of the heavens a spirit known only as Ul.
In utter dismay, Tenedra realized that he fully intended to recite the entire book to her. After a few moments of chagrin, however, she began to feel the strangely compelling quality of the story. More than she would have cared to admit, she was moved by the first Gorum's appeal to the indifferent spirit that appeared to him at Prolgo. What manner of man would thus dare to accuse a god? As she listened, a faint flicker seemed to tug at the corner of her eye. She glanced toward it, and saw a soft glow somewhere deep within the massive rocks that formed one of the walls of the chamber. The glow was peculiarly different from the dim light of the hanging crystal globes.
Then was the heart of Gorum made glad, the old man continued his recitation, and he called the name of the high place where all of this had come to pass, Prolgo, which is holy place.